As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic. I'm Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. And two days after opening the season with a 3-0 shutout loss to Carolina, the Red Wings came back, and they came back and beat the Hurricanes 4-2 on the back of Filip Zadina with two assists, Dylan Larkin with two goals, and I think more important than any of that, an ability to respond when adversity hit. Multiple times in the third period, they gave up one-goal leads. I think last year that would have killed them, and I think Dylan Larkin acknowledged that afterwards. Prashant, what did you see that was different last night than Thursday and last night than a year ago?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like, you know, you look at that game, and the Red Wings are leading 1-0 after two periods, having played it, you know, kind of reasonably tight and very similar to the first game of the season, right? It was a similar kind of hockey game heading into that third period. And, you know, all of a sudden, 30 seconds into the third period, Svechnikov, you know, shoots the puck, it ricochets off of Trocheck. It's in the back of the net. And that last season would have been a turning point for the Red Wings team. They would have kind of collapsed. They would have not been able to, you know, mount the same pressure that they had been pushing kind of throughout the game. They wouldn't have that same kind of offensive excitement. And so, you know, I would have expected that team to just collapse. Unlike last season, what you actually saw was the team continued to fight. They continued to push. They were able to play reasonably even, you know, with the Hurricanes in the third period. I say reasonably even because the stats were not even, but, you know, reasonably even from a Red Wings perspective that it was not as bad as it could have been. And then they ultimately got the break. You know, they get the late goal where Filip Zadina is able to pick the puck up right after the power play expires and find Fabry in front of the net. And they get the game-winning goal there, and Larkin seals it with an empty netter. So just a huge change in mentality, you know, for the Red Wings compared to what we would have seen last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think watching night one to watching night two, there were small differences, but I don't think it was like, you know, an adjustment or something like something that was tactically all that different. I thought Filip Zadina played a better game. I thought Bobby Ryan's entering the lineup allowed a really, I thought, much better balance of lines. And I thought they would keep Namestnikov with those other two because I liked how Namestnikov had looked, especially in the last scrimmage alongside Fabry and Zadina. But man, once Bobby Ryan got in there, you know, he hadn't played in quite a long time. And I thought you immediately could see what he brought. I mean, it was patience, it was poise, it was smarts, and of course skill. And he gets the first goal, and that's really big. But it was created by Zadina. And importantly, the thing that we saw throughout training camp in Zadina that maybe hadn't shown up in a big way on Thursday night was his ability to get to loose pucks, get to pucks that Carolina was possessing. And that's really what he did here. He pulls a puck off of a Hurricane stick, corrals it immediately, takes it below the goal line and sets up Ryan for a premium chance, and he buries it. And, it's one of those things where I don't think that it was a world of difference between games one and two, but when you see things like that go in, I think it reinforces that what we thought on Thursday was a tight game for two periods, if not in shots on goal, at least in terms of shot quality. It reinforces that you pick your spots, and as long as you convert when the moments arise, you'll be in games.
Yeah, that seems to be what Jeff Blashill's system has been for the majority of his tenure with the Red Wings. And obviously, I think last season, the talent level, dropped off to the point such that the Wings really couldn't keep the game close to take advantage of those opportunities. But now this season, I think you're seeing, at a minimum, a reversion back to where you were in 2018, 2019, where you're still a bottom five team, but you are competitive in hockey games. You are able to, keep the game close. You're not giving up tons and tons of grade A chances to a really good Carolina team. You're almost kind of taking death by a thousand blows as opposed to, a couple of big, massive, shots against. And I think that's going to be the style that's going to at least allow the Red Wings to, stay roughly competitive in these kinds of hockey games. And, let's not kid ourselves here. You still look at the 5-on-5 stats in those two games. The Wings are 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage of 33% in both those games. I mean, they're 10% worse than any other team in the NHL right now after those two games against Carolina. So they're still far from being a extraordinarily, competitive hockey team. But I think their strategy of minimizing how dangerous an individual chance can be and, almost giving up a larger quantity of kind of medium to low danger chances allows them to stay in the hockey games to where Filip Zadina forces a turnover and you get a quick goal. Dylan Larkin gets the puck that ricochets off a player's skate. You get a goal. Zadina makes another great pickup and you get another goal. And so it's taking advantage of those bounces by keeping yourself competitive in the hockey game.
It is, and they're not going to be able to do to teams what Carolina does to teams. Like, it's just not realistic. Carolina is one of the deepest teams. They have the top level talent. They have the Aho, the Svechnikov, Slavin, Dougie Hamilton. The Red Wings don't have that. Like, I understand the attractiveness of being able to outshoot a team 2-1 over the course of a 2-game series. If Detroit tries it, they'll lose. They can try to open things up, and they will lose that way because they just don't have the guns to play that style. But if you jam things up and you make everything a shot from the outside the other way and you try to find your spots going your way, that's the way they can win. It doesn't mean it's the most aesthetically pleasing. I can imagine that it can be quite frustrating to watch. I can imagine it was quite frustrating for Carolina to play, and that's kind of the idea behind it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly it. Like, this is not the same Red Wings team you saw a decade ago that was doing to teams what Carolina basically does to teams now and what they usually, do to Detroit teams. And so from Detroit's standpoint, their point is, how do I minimize the damage? And last season, what you would see is you'd see these big defensive zone collapses, breakaways against, one-timers against, cross-slot passes, really high chances of scoring against. And so historically, when we talk about, high danger chances, or we talk about shots that have a high probability of going in, we sometimes think of shots great that have maybe a greater than 20% probability of going in. In the two games against Carolina, the Wings gave up 3 of those shots at 5-on-5. 3 shots that had a greater than 20% probability of going in. And I think that's what you need to see from this team. They need to be able to minimize those big chances against, and I think that's what allowed them to stay in the hockey game. They're never going to look good statistically, but if they can keep those high danger chances away from their net, they're going to be able to be a little more competitive.
How many of those chances were saved by Filip Peronik on that one sequence in the crease?
That's exactly it, right? So, the big one, the Carolina's most dangerous chance was the one saved by Filip Peronik in the crease. And so you look at it and you're like, okay, well, that was a big break for the Red Wings there, and that's why they were able to escape there. So really, you're talking about two other chances between two games against a very good Carolina team that you were able to limit, and that's the big difference, I think, between this team and last year's team is minimizing those. I mean, really, you know, even aside from 20%, even if you expand the range to 10%, you only had seven shots. These are unblocked chances. So anything that was missed or on the net that had greater than 10% probability of going in the back of the net. So the Wings did a really nice job of kind of minimizing the danger there.
The flip side of this is that another area where they're not like last year's team is that last year's team was really carried by a dominant top line when they were doing well. They were being carried by their best line, Dylan Larkin, Anthony Mantha, and Tyler Bertuzzi. Larkin does get two goals last night. He probably arguably should have had a hat trick. He passed up an open net to try and set up Vladislav Domestikov for his first goal as a Red Wing. I didn't mind it. The game was in hand. Domestikov had had a couple of tough breaks on breakaways. I can understand wanting to help him get off the schneid, so to speak. But, you know, the rest of the way, I didn't think, aside from those two goals, that this top line has looked like itself so far.
Yeah, the top line has been, you know, really, really far from what you would expect. And it's kind of funny, you know, we did our season preview and we talked about how important it was going to be to get scoring behind the top line. But the top line's not been good. You know, last year, the Larkin, Mantha, Bertuzzi line, they were still the one line that looked like a competitive hockey line. They were, you know, 5-on-5 expected goals, 4 percentage, north of 52%. They were a line combination that was at least able to control play against the best of the other team. This season, they've been so far from that mark. And again, two games in, both against Carolina, a team that's a matchup nightmare for them. But that line has been quite bad. I mean, you're talking about almost 30 minutes of ice time at 5-on-5, and you're looking at a 5-on-5 expected goals, 4 percentage of 31%. That is 20-plus percent below where that line was last year. Again, note the opponent, note the sample size we're talking about, but far from what they're capable of, because they should be able to hold their own against Carolina. In fact, the Wings have been almost 10% better from an expected goals 4 percentage with each of those three guys off the ice at 5-on-5, which is very surprising. And I think a lot of that's boosted by the great showing from the third line last night with Sam Gagner, yep, Valtteri Filppula, and Vladislav Namestnikov. I thought that line was Detroit's best line of the night, you know, in terms of being able to consistently generate dangerous chances. But yeah, that line just has not looked like what you would have expected, at least early on.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
I think a lot of people have pointed out, and certainly I noticed this last night in particular, like Anthony Mantha doesn't seem to have the jump that you saw from him at his best last year. It's interesting to me because in camp, I've felt like he has. And it's been unusual to see. I'm not someone who thinks that, like, you know, a two-game stretch where a guy isn't jumping off the ice is a big concern. I think maybe because they're the first two games of the season, it's easy for people to say, oh God, what happened? Like, what does this mean? I don't think it means anything. I think it means he had two kind of rocky games and is getting back into the swing after 10 months. It also doesn't surprise me that one of Detroit's like physically largest players might take a couple more games to really get the legs under him. But I don't know. I didn't think it looked, it stood out in a negative way at all during camp. And so the fact that you did notice times where you're like, man, you know, Mantha would get a pass up by the offensive blue line, and where in the past, maybe you'd see him try to power pass the defender and take a real power move to the net. You saw him kind of delay and try to set something up that way. And inherently, I don't have a problem with it. It's just when it happens over and over again, and you're not seeing quite the difference maker, or really, you know, remotely the difference maker that Mantha was last year. I can understand why people are curious about it. That was the number one thing that we got in the mailbox when we asked for questions today, was what's up with Anthony Mantha. I don't know. I'm not sure that it's going to be a thing we're still talking about in a week, but I wanted to see your take on it. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because it is very atypical to see him do that, to see him be so passive on the ice. I think the biggest indicator of kind of how passive he was is he's not shooting the puck. The guy has two shots on goal, and that's just not where he wants to be. And I think he'll tell you that himself. You know, he was talking about wanting to put on, you know, 3, 4, 5 shots on goal a night, and he's got 2 through 2 games, and really has only shot the puck in the direction of the net 8 times total. So far from where he wants to be, and it is a little surprising to see. I mean, you know, we talk about it being a small sample, and they're not being, you know, a huge thing for or huge cause for concern. You know, in the second game against Carolina, you look at his 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage, it was 22.8%. That's the 10th worst game of his career. And so it's still a striking number to see for a guy who's usually 2 to 3 times higher than that in a lot of games. So, I mean, last season he was at a 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage of 55.4%. So, you know, 30% higher than where he's at right now. And so I think there's a lot that we need to sort out here. I agree that I don't think it's going to be an issue down the road. I think he's still trying to find his game. We're talking about guys who haven't played competitive hockey in 10 months. May take a little bit to get going here. Potentially people are a little frustrated because you're not getting 4 goals like you did in the season opener last year with Anthony Mantha against Dallas. So I think give it time. This guy's an incredibly talented player, arguably the most talented player on the Red Wings. He's going to find his game. But yes, he has had a couple of rough outings.
To reinforce, like, I thought Zadina was really good last night. And so what's the difference there? Well, Zadina's been playing for 3 months. And yeah, he had that little quarantine period before camp. But that doesn't surprise me that might be the case, right? Like, we didn't see... Zadina was great immediately in the Czech League, too. I think he had 2 goals in his first game. So I don't know. But... nonetheless, it's just not something that I think merits like a real, you know, pick everything apart. What could this be? And I know he just signed a new contract. I don't think it merits going that deep. I don't think it's that deep is basically what I'm saying.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think this is something to get super worked up about. I think if we're revisiting this in a week or two and we're still talking about a similar issue and the top line still hasn't found their game, then I think we have a legitimate problem here. And you have to start to wonder what's going on with him. But through 2 games against an elite opponent, an opponent that arguably is one of the top 5 Stanley Cup contenders this season, and again, is a matchup nightmare for Detroit, I'm not particularly worried as of yet.
Throughout his career, too, he's shown that even if he gives you a run of 4 or 5 quiet games, he tends to give it all back and a little more when he has the 4 or 5 games up. He's a player who I've known to have to stack multi-point games on top of one another. And so I imagine that's still coming. He did get an assist last night on the Larkin goal. I didn't think it was a particularly pretty one. I mean, the goal itself was not a pretty one. He also could have ended up with that goal if it doesn't go off Vincent Trocheck's stick first. So I don't know how different a conversation we're having if that happens. I also think the fact that he seemed to be the guy, I think, who kind of had the responsibility to go get Nino Niederreiter on the first goal Thursday night. Yeah, the Red Wings got discombobulated there, and they had numbers, but they were clustered, and I think it was due to the transition. But, you know, Mantha's the guy in the frame when you look over at Niederreiter, who's, you know, not exactly in stride as Niederreiter catches that pass and buries it. I think we're seeing a combination of, you know, that image, and then you see those things I talked about with the puck on the offensive blue line. I think it's going to come, but we'll see what happens on that front. And we'll actually see very quickly. You guys might not have a long shelf life to listen to this episode here because Red Wings are going to play Columbus at noon on Monday. And I'm curious to see that because Carolina, where they are a super, you know, high-end talent deep team, Columbus does it a little different. They do have some elite talent. They've got Seth Jones, Zach Werenski, and Pierre-Luc Dubois, whose name everyone has gotten quite familiar with lately. They are deep, but they also seem to play this style that I think is not all that dissimilar to how the Red Wings want to be and just high compete, keep the pressure on. And so I'm really curious to see that as a little bit of a measuring stick game for their resolve, because I think Columbus is going to test every bit of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Columbus is almost like if you're Detroit and your season goes perfectly, you want to almost be Columbus light to a certain extent. I mean, you just look and stack up kind of what they do and you see, okay, they're an aggressive forechecking team. They play really well. They really muck up the neutral zone. Not easy to transition in. I think the biggest advantage Columbus has, you know, over Detroit is their blue line, right? You've got guys like Seth Jones and Zach Werenski who can make great outlet passes and kind of do a much better job with transition. And then obviously they're built on a foundation of great goaltending. So, you know, that's a team that, you know, when I look at the Red Wings right now in their current makeup, they're almost trying to be a Columbus light. And unfortunately, they haven't really mastered it. 0-3 against Columbus last year, didn't do a good job playing them. And so I think it'll be a huge test to see, you know, where you're at. It's not going to be pretty hockey. It's going to be very ugly to watch. But again, the uglier it is, the kind of more you're recognizing the Red Wings are competitive in that kind of game.
What are you most curious to see in that standpoint? Is it how the Red Wings forwards lines are able to stack up against the Seth Jones and Zach Werenskis of the world? Is it the just energy level and if they can keep up? What are you looking to see here?
I think the thing I'm most looking to see is can the first line get back on track? Yeah. You know, you had a very difficult matchup, you know, because again, when Carolina's rolling two lines, I mean, line one is Aho and Teravainen, and then line two is Svechnikov and Natchez. That's not an easy, and those two lines are incredibly puck possession oriented. And so if you're matching up against those guys, you're just not playing with the puck. You transition to Columbus, the forward talent isn't on the same level. It's not a knock on Columbus. It's just a reality. And so can Detroit and have their top line possess the puck more? You know, is there going to be more of a matchup situation here? Does Tortorella want certain guys? I think he'll probably care more about his defensive pairings with Jones and Werenski than he will necessarily the forward line that matches up against that Manta, Larkin, Bertuzzi line. But can those guys get going with their puck possession game and kind of find the heights they had last year?
Yeah, I think that's a great one. And certainly the top line remains one to watch. For me, I'm curious about the goaltending. The Red Wings got good goaltending this weekend, and they weren't always tested in those super high danger moments, but the workload was still really high, and now they're going to go into a back-to-back here against a Columbus team that should be able to get traffic to the net, and you expect them to be tested right again. This is going to be a relentless season for the goalies, and it's why I think it's important that Detroit went out and got Thomas Greiss, and they have what I think is a true tandem that you're going to get pretty consistent goaltending no matter who's back there. I think they're both over 930 after one game each, and that's the smallest sample size imaginable by definition. But we'll see how it holds up against Columbus, because I think so far it's been basically what you draw up.
Yeah, I mean, the goaltending, it was really going to be the X factor between where does Detroit end up finishing this year. I think a lot of people, you know, looked at the Thomas Greiss signing and said, uh-oh, does that actually, you know, if Detroit can defend reasonably well enough, instead of having those Jimmy Howard games that you had last year, now you've got a guy who's been very consistently good the last 3 or 4 years. And now, granted, how is he going to transition from the Barry Trotz Islanders system to Detroit? But, I mean, you're absolutely right, Max. Through two games, both those guys saved a goal above expected. And if the Wings continue to get that kind of goaltending, I don't think they will, but if they continue to get, you know, even goaltending that puts them in that ballpark, I mean, you're going to see a lot of really close games and a lot of games that are entering the third period with maybe a one goal difference. And I think that's going to do wonders for the Red Wings' psyche and morale that you're hitting the third period and you're not down 3-0, 4-0, 5-1 like you were last year. you are very competitive in your games because of those guys.
I picked the Red Wings to finish ahead of Chicago in the Central Division this year, and while I still think the Red Wings are going to be a bottom two or three team in the league, the reason I did it was almost 100% related to goaltending, as well as Chicago's health up front with their centers. But I just think Greiss and Bernier are going to be able to keep them in games to a degree that Colin Delia, Malcolm Subban, and eventually Kevin Lankinen potentially are just going to have a tougher time doing, not because they're not talented players, but just because they haven't had to do it yet. None of them have had a season in which they've ever started 20 games. Well, at least one of them is going to have to this year, and most likely at least two of them are going to have to. So I'm curious to see how that goes, and it's a big reason why I think Chicago's in for a tough season, and it's one of the areas I think Detroit, upgraded the most, probably the area I think Detroit upgraded the most this offseason. So that's what I'll say for me. I'm also curious to see the defense rotation and how that continues to progress. Filip Hronek, they wanted to play like 7 minutes in the first period. He got 9. And then I thought they actually did a great job of scaling him back without really putting themselves in bad situations. After playing 9 minutes in the first period, they actually got him under 25 minutes for the game, which is a little bit of a feat. And it's something that we have talked about on the show. It's something Jeff Blashill has talked about. It's just going to be tough for them to balance. He is their best defenseman. We talked about laying his body on the line to literally keep a puck out of the net. There's no doubt that was a goal if he doesn't get in there. I think it was a goal at least two different times because he got stick on puck on one that wasn't even technically a shot. I don't think it counts as a block or anything, but it was a big play. I think he saved 2 goals in 4 seconds there. So they're going to have to find a way to manage him. And at the same time, Danny DeKeyser and Mark Stahl are throwing up red flags for me. And I think DeKeyser only played like 13, 14 minutes last night. I still don't think he looks comfortable. I thought, in camp, again, I've said this about a couple different guys. In camp, I didn't think it looked egregious. But I think when you see it in the live flow of a full-speed game, it does stand out that this does not look like fully healthy Danny DeKeyser. I think that's a concern. I thought Mark Stahl was actually better last night, but I'm still... Andrei Svechnikov had that one play on his goal to tie the game at 2-2 where he forces Stahl to rim it up the boards, and that leads to the turnover that goes to, I don't know if you call it a turnover because it's up the boards, that's a routine play, but whatever you want to call it, it leads to the Svechnikov goal like 2 seconds later, and it's one of those things where those are two guys where I'm curious to see how they play. I did think Stahl was better last night, and I actually think advanced stats-wise, he might have been one of their top defensemen. He and Stetcher's pairing was out there for a lot of possession and a lot of quality chances for Detroit. But I'm really curious to see how they manage this rotation because they're clearly going to have to shelter DeKeyser. And that's a tough aim to meet when you're also trying to, just keep Hronek in the land of the reasonable minutes.
It's going to be really tough because, through the first two games, there wasn't a lot of things that looked really good. I thought Stetcher looked really solid in the second game, more so than the first. And I do think he kind of carried his pairing up where, you end up looking at the stats, you're absolutely right. I mean, the Stahl, Stahl actually comes in at a 5-on-5 Corsi 4 percentage of 61%, which is, the best amongst defensemen on the team.
And for what Stetcher the total was, that's nuts.
Right, right. And yeah, exactly. Because, we're talking about Carolina had basically clowned Detroit for most of the game and was, around 60-some percent. As a team. But, again, when you look at the numbers there, I think that's largely driven by Stetcher. The Svechnikov play you call out, I think, is key because not only did Stahl turn the puck over, he then got beat back to the middle of the ice by Svechnikov. And yes, it's not fair. Andrei Svechnikov is 20. Mark Stahl is almost double his age. But still, as soon as you make that turnover, Svechnikov immediately heads to the front of the net, puck finds a stick, and then he's able to score that goal. Those are the kinds of plays that drive you nuts where it's a forced turnover in the sense that, you kind of waited with the puck on your stick a little too long. You got your hand forced and then you make the mistake in coverage where you're not able to get back in time. So, the Wings really need help for Filip Hronek because he is going to end up playing a boatload of minutes again. I think I'm looking at it, Max. He's at 25-22. Looking at the score sheet from last night.
So they didn't keep him under 25.
So again, north of 25 minutes, that's going to wear on him, especially with all these games being jam-packed. It's not an 82-game season, but you know, 56 in 116 days is going to be kind of, I think it's going to feel the same way for a lot of these guys. So somebody somewhere has to step up and help him. And maybe it's moving Troy Stetcher to play with Patrick Nemeth instead of Mark Staal, so you can at least have a more solid second pairing.
Well, to John Merrill, you mean, because Nemeth's been with Hrant.
Yeah, John Merrill, yes.
Then you got the Kaiser and Staal on the same pair, and then, you know, are you giving that crew 14, 15 minutes, or what's the... I guess that's probably.
I think you have to. I mean, because, you know, right now DeKaiser's not showing that he's capable of really playing more of those minutes.
No, I agree.
And I think you still have to ease him back in from this back injury. But yeah, maybe you do that. Or, you know, hey, the Wings just waived Alex Biega to make way for Christian Juice. Maybe you get Juice in for some games here and play some Mark Staal and at least see what he looks like. So
I think Juice, you know, is going to be a few days. He comes out of quarantine Monday, and then they don't have another practice actually official as a team until Thursday, because it's going to be game Monday, Tuesday. They haven't had a day off since last Tuesday, so they got to get a day off in on Wednesday where they can. He'll be skating, so that'll be good for him to get his legs back under him to be in the full swing Thursday. But I still think... You know, I don't know that he's going to be ready for the Chicago first game at least, but I think your head's in the right spot there. And I think getting him in, like, I know people were asking, like, in our comments, could Juice go in for Staal? I think it's much more likely that he would go in for DeKaiser, just given how much they've clearly had to shelter him and ease that back. And it's something Jeff Blashill was, frankly, really clear in trying to prepare expectations for during camp. But then they kept playing him with Hronek in every scrimmage, and I was like, well, okay, I guess they're just going to see how this goes. But now we're seeing, I think, what the vision was, which was Hronek and Nemeth played together all of last year. They probably didn't really need the reps all that much on the same pair in those scrimmages. So we will see how that goes. I'm very curious about the defense rotation, and I haven't seen Juice yet, so I don't know necessarily what he will bring there. What's his deal? Do you know?
Looking at him, he's a guy who's always had a little bit of excitement around his name when he was in Washington and then when he was in Anaheim. But you're also still talking about a guy who's now kind of starting to get past the, hey, why haven't you been made it and been able to stick,
right?
You know, certain territories. So, you know, is he better than Alex Biega? I mean, maybe. Is he going to be a difference maker? Probably not. You know, he's a guy you can rotate in at 6'7", not going to get super worked up or excited about it. But as of right now, he may offer you a far better option than at least two of Detroit's defensemen. So not a bad guy to at least rotate in and see if he can do anything different for you.
Yeah. So we will see how that continues to progress. And who knows? I mean, it's going to come so fast that I'm curious to see at what point, you know, might you just try to start rotating guys in every once in a while for maintenance reasons almost. I know there's some guys, Hronik's not going to get that luxury. Stetcher's not going to get that luxury. Merrill's not going to get that luxury. Nemeth's not, but we'll see what else happens there.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Do you want to go to the mailbag really quick before we wrap up?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So one of the ones, as I go in search of our prompt here, that stood out to me, someone was asking about play driving and whether it's a learned skill or whether it comes organically. And I wanted to know what you thought on that front. And it's from Katie Lady is the question asker. Can someone learn to drive play or is it innate?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And, you know, one that I have not admittedly thought about a lot to see if, you know, certain players can actually make substantial strides in their 5-5 expected goals, 4% or 5-5 Corsi, 4% over the course of their career. I do think there are certain players who get better and better at it. But you look at a lot of the guys who were elite in that respect, or at least that we think of as elite, and they've really been elite most of their career. I think a lot of it has to do, you know, with how they think the game, how good and responsible they are defensively. I think that's a big factor in there. And so that's why, you know, a guy like Anthony Mantha, who's consistently been, you know, towards the top of his team each and every year of his career, I think that's an innate skill for him. And that's something that's probably translated. But the challenge with being able to decide if it's innate or learned is we don't have a lot of that good info from juniors, the CHL, the USHL. You know, those leagues don't really allow us to see, is there a consistent kind of at every level, these guys are those guys, or, you know, once they hit the NHL, that's where it seems to come from. I certainly think you can get bumps from, you know, all of a sudden you're now the Pittsburgh winger playing on Crosby's line. You're going to get that bump. But as far as being that person responsible for driving the line, I kind of lean towards it's a something you've kind of learned in how you play as opposed to something you learn later on in your career.
That's interesting because I see it more as descriptive than anything else. Like I see play driving as not being like a kind of skill, but as just like it's what happens when you pile up a few different skills on top of each other. And to me, those skills are being able to hold on to the puck and both exit and enter the zone. I think those are things that can be worked on, but do kind of draw on some innate puck skill and hockey sense. And I think it's a ability to turn the puck over when you don't have it and get it going the other way. And so when you talk about someone like Filip Zadina, has not been a play driver to this point in his career, but I think he still can be one because he has the skill to exit and enter the zone, and he's developing the ability to hunt the puck and cause turnovers and get it going the other way. To me, those are the musts for play driving because ultimately what it comes down to is possession, right? Like, What to me play driving means is you're someone who makes it possible for your team to have the puck more than not have the puck and have it in the offensive zone. And so I think of it as a descriptor of a combination of skills, some of which are innate and some of which can be worked on. And so I think the answer goes to like what kind of player are we talking about here? Like, do I think that Michael Rasmussen can become a play driver? Only insofar as I think he can cause turnovers. I don't think he's a guy who you're going to want on entries and exits so much. And I don't think he's a guy that you're going to want holding onto the puck a ton. But I think he can help, quote unquote, drive play for a line by turning the puck over. Anthony Mantha is a guy who can do it all. Dylan Larkin's a guy who can do it all. Filip Zadina is a guy who looks like he's developing into a player who can do that. Lucas Raymond's a guy who I have no doubt can do that. So I think it's a blend, and I don't know if that's getting too deep in the weeds on it, but I guess that'd be my take on it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an interesting question. I actually tend to believe it's much more of a defensive skill than an offensive skill.
Yeah.
In that sense of you are, you know, when you possess the puck, you're possessing the puck, but you do the reads you make defensively allow you to, you know, get the puck back that much quicker. You know, it's almost like when you're doing like NHL 21 and you're doing the be a pro mode and you're designing your player, it's like maxing out the defensive IQ bar is kind of what I think is the ultimate driver. And you look at the guys who've always been elite, it's the Bergerons, the Datsuks, the Mark Stones, the Ryan O'Reillys, the guys that have this innate defensive sense.
Yep.
That they know where to be. And that's why I don't think it's necessarily a learned skill. But that being said, it's not just one factor. There's a lot of things that kind of boil down into it. You know, you look at a guy like Thomas Tatar, he doesn't fit that conventional sense, but
yeah,
his numbers are always off the charts. And I do think it's because defensively, he is so responsible and good with his positioning that his line tends to end up with the puck back.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I do think it's important to note that it can look different ways for different players, because what it ultimately is about is getting the puck into where into your hands and into the zone that you want it to be in consistently throughout the course of a game. Different guys are going to do that different ways. So I think that's a very good point. And I think Tatar is a great example of it. Here's your alley-oop for the day. You only get one. Jack Powers asks, this isn't Red Wings specific, but what are your thoughts on a team running a power play from behind the net? as opposed to the modern day version of a quarterback at the point. I believe people such as Ryan Stimson have touched on this before. And one of those people such as Ryan Stimson is you, Prashanth.
You know, Ryan and I have talked about this idea for a long time. Even, you know, if you need to go check out his book, make sure you check out the book that he wrote on this, talking about this philosophy to a certain extent. But, you know, when you're playing from behind the net, just think back to the 80s. And we talked about this being Gretzky's office. Well, why was Gretzky so good from back there? It's because you've got everybody looking, you know, basically behind the net. You've got the goalie craning their net, and you're taking away attention from the guys who are moving into, you know, dangerous positions. I think Gretzky was so good when he was behind the net at finding the guys who were creeping into the slot, finding the guy in the back door. And so when you do that, it really taxes the defense to how do they keep track of where the puck is. And how do they keep track of where the kind of attackers are on the offensive side? And so, you know, you look at Detroit last night, and even though none of them were power play goals, all three of Detroit's goals that came before the empty netter were generated from plays behind the net.
Yep.
And it's because the goalie's got to crane his neck to be able to see that where the puck is. You know, that he has that difficulty there. And then as soon as that puck comes out into the slot, that goalie's got to quickly snap his head back, identify where the shooter is or where that puck is going, and then make a strong push. And they get one shot at this, make a strong push to come out and close the angle. And it's very difficult to do. You saw it on the Bobby Ryan goal where Zadina finds Bobby Ryan really quickly. Mrazek in one movement has to snap his head to the front, make a push out of the slot, and he doesn't get himself set before Bobby Ryan shooting the puck. You saw the same deal on the Robbie Fabry goal. I think it makes a lot of sense. And if you can start baiting defenders to chase you behind the net, you can start really breaking down the system that is, you know, the other team's penalty kill. So to me, it just makes too much sense to not do this.
Carolina does it with Aho, right? He's their guy back there.
Yeah, I mean, Carolina does it with Aho. You watch the Capitals. They run a lot of it from the goal line, you know, with Nick Backstrom and Evgeny Kuznetsov. They do this right around the goal line area, not necessarily behind the net. But again, similar concept where you've got your attention away from the dangerous areas for the defensemen. So I think some teams incorporate this to a certain extent, and I think it definitely adds another dimension to the power play. And, you know, not to derail us too much here, but, you know, you think about the comparisons back to other sports, right? You look at sports like the NFL and take, for example, what the Green Bay Packers did with Devontae Adams to being able to get him away from Jalen Ramsey and kind of breaking down. You know, there's all these different kinds of motions and sets and formations, and you just don't really see a lot of that in hockey. It's almost like we're just going to sit here in one formation and we're going to let the PK sit there in one formation. And how are we going to break this down? And to me, that's where you need to have different looks. You need to have the look where you're running it from the left half boards. You need to have the look where you're running it from behind the net. You need to have multiple entry plays. But hockey tends to be very fixed in like, hey, this works, and so we're going to keep doing this. But it's how do you create this motion offense that gets Jalen Ramsey running the length of the end zone twice that gets you an easy touchdown to Devontae Adams? How do you do that? And so that's where I think adding a dimension like being able to run your power play from behind the net is key to teams kind of improving their success.
Very interesting. Okay, Chris Ripley. The pros and cons of trying to acquire Pierre-Luc Dubois. Is it really worth gambling on the lottery this year with so many unknowns? I can't tell if he's saying trading a lottery pick or is he advocating for trading a lottery pick because of the unknowns. But either way, let's just take the broad pros and cons of trying to acquire Pierre-Luc Dubois and I guess implied their thoughts on including an unprotected lottery pick as part of that.
Yeah, I think the way I read that question, it sort of seems like the implication is the Wings would have to trade a lottery pick, whether it's 2021, 2022, something along those lines. I think if you're Detroit, Pierre-Luc Dubois is certainly an attractive player. I mean, you've got him 2 years at $5 million for his average annual value right now, which is great. And he's going to be a restricted free agent at the end of that. I believe he's still 22 years old, and he's going to be a solid two-way center. He's going to be a first-line center. I think the pendulum sort of swung a little bit from slightly underrated to now very much overrated when people are starting to try and pin down his value. But if I'm Detroit, you know, one deal that I've kind of floated that I think makes sense doesn't involve a lottery pick. It's Anthony Mantha for Pierre-Luc Dubois. And you look at Columbus and go, well, why does Columbus do that? Well, you know, Mantha is still an elite play driver. He's a guy who can score a lot. You know, you give Columbus another goal scoring forward that they haven't really had since Artemi Panarin there. You know, obviously Dubois is a good goal scorer himself, but, you know, being able to have Anthony Mantha on that team and to play with Cam Atkinson and taking passes from Seth Jones and Zach Werenski, that's another dimension. But Mantha's locked up under a contract for a handful of years at a below market value. And if Columbus views themselves as a cup contender or a playoff contender, they maybe are a team that's willing to take the bite on, hey, let me get a guy who's equally talented to the player I'm giving up, who is under contract for longer and is at under contract for a below market value. And potentially that offers me some savings to go out and get some other guys. So, you know, that would be one way to do it. I don't know that I necessarily want to part with a draft pick if you're Detroit, but, you know, if you can come up with a package that's not a first round draft pick to acquire a 22-year-old potential first line center, I say you got to try at least.
Well, you're not going to get it without a first round pick, though, you know, unless you go your route. And I understand what you're saying. You know, the pros to me, the pros of trying to acquire Pierre-Luc Dubois, 22-year-old first line center with upside to be even more, right? I think this is a guy who he's a 6'3" player who can play both ends of the ice, who can score, who can defend. Like, this is the starter kit for the kind of two-way center the Red Wings have seemed to gravitate toward for certainly as long as I've been on the beat. And you get one of those behind Dylan Larkin, and all of a sudden you kind of have one of the things we've been talking about, which is if you're not going to be able to get an elite generational, you know, Pedersen type at the top, what you need is to just clone Dylan Larkin. And while I think he and Dubois aren't necessarily the same player, the statistical profile of the impact, you could have basically that. You could have your Larkin and Dubois on the top two lines as lines that can match up with anybody and they can score at the same time. So as for what it would cost, I don't know. I imagine it would be quite high. I mean, the team that I think most people want to connect Dubois to, because he's French-Canadian, is Montreal. And I think the conversation starter that everyone talks about there is Nick Suzuki. And so there you're talking about another young center. And while I think people get too precious about players like Nick Suzuki because he's really only a year younger than Dubois, and Dubois is much more established in the same mold, it's still like you see what that is, right? And it's the natural inclination is if you're trading a former third overall pick, two-way center who's the number one center in the NHL, in my opinion, they're going to want another young center. And so the Red Wings don't have that to give. They could try to make something work with Mantha, but Columbus at that point would basically have to decide, are we a rebuilder or are we going for it? And I just don't see how they can really look at themselves and say that they could go for it and succeed. They've won a couple playoff series in the last couple years, but have they ever really looked like a real threat? Like they're just that one player away from winning it all? Not to me.
Yeah, I mean, Columbus has never looked like the team that's going to win it, to me, for sure. I think that's definitely fair. You know, it's all about how they perceive themselves. You know, do they perceive that they are a couple right. pieces away? Do they perceive that, you know, hey, if I go out and I get a guy like Mantha who is under contract for 4 years and I, in the next 2 years, think I can add pieces that will make this team better, then sure. You know, you make that deal for Columbus. I'm with you. If I was Columbus, I don't know that I necessarily make that deal. But if you're Steve Yzerman, you're sort of thinking about, am I going to be able to maximize the value of Dylan Larkin, Tyler Bertuzzi, and Anthony Mantha as they're, you know, 25 and 26 right now? Or could I almost reset my timeline a little bit by dropping, you know, from Mantha being a 26-year-old to, you know, Pierre-Luc Dubois being a 22-year-old, if that's a possibility? So, you know, I think it's definitely on the table to think about, but, you know, it's going to be tough. I suspect, you know, even though the deal I'm laying out is fair value per, you know, this trade machine I've built, it's unlikely that that's what it takes to get it done, because I think Dubois' value is somewhat inflated, you know, by the amount of conversation that's going on right now and the fact that you'll have other offers in play.
So this is where we come back to the first round pick that that Chris is talking about. And in my opinion,
I say, if that's what it is it's a first round pick and maybe you're throwing in a prospect or something, I think Dubois is young enough you can justify it. Now, does that mean it's not bulletproof? Like, the Red Wings could finish bottom five still with Pierre-Luc Dubois potentially, and that pick could win the lottery, and then you've traded either Owen Power or Luke Hughes or whatever to Columbus, and maybe you're suddenly realizing that you've just become Nashville in the Ryan Johansson, Seth Jones trade, and then maybe you regret it. But I don't think it's an unreasonable price. In fact, I think it's the reasonable price is an unprotected first from a lottery team plus something else for a guy who was the third overall pick like 4 years ago and has proven why. Like, it's not like you're talking about a guy who was a top three pick, and you're not talking about Jesse Puljujärvi actually as the guy who was one spot behind Dubois, where he was a top five pick, but now, you know, there's a ton of uncertainty around him. You're talking about a guy who was a top three pick and looks like it, and is young enough that you're going to get his whole prime if you trade for him. So I wouldn't have any problem trading an unprotected first round pick, even in the top five for him. But you have to have, some intestinal fortitude there to pull the trigger on it, because you might lose that trade.
Yeah. I mean, you very well could. Now, we know Steve Yzerman is not shy about making deals that will very much shake things up. I mean, you look at the Martin St. Louis deal, you look at, you know, trading Jonathan Drouin, who was widely regarded to be extremely good, and getting Mikhail Sergachev out of it. Now you compare the two, and no one would make that deal today if you're the person holding Sergachev. So it'll be interesting to see. Yzerman certainly has the capacity to make that deal. And, to be clear, it's not the worst thing in the world to give up a first rounder. If you're Detroit, you know, especially this year with there not really being a clear cut number one, it's not like you're missing out on a huge sweepstakes like you were with last year. That being said, there's still very good players in this draft. You know, Matty Beniers has looked outstanding, and, you know, Atu Rotty is starting to pick it up, and you know, some of the other defensemen, Carson Lambos and Brant Clark, they look pretty good as well. So, you know, we'll see. It wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to do, but it would be a tough pill to swallow if all of a sudden that's the year you win the lottery.
No doubt. I mean, I saw this comment. It was about the Lions on Twitter, and I'm really sorry. I don't have no memory of who said it, but it was someone replying it to our Lions writer, Chris Burke. The Lions hired a new GM, obviously, this week. And their point was, draft picks are meant to help you bring talent into the organization. Most commonly, that's by using the draft pick and making a selection and bringing in, in the NFL, a 21-year-old, in the NHL, an 18-year-old into your organization. If you want to trade that draft pick and bring in a 22-year-old instead, I don't have a problem with it. You still use the draft pick for its intended purpose, which was to bring young talent into your organization. This one carries a little less uncertainty, and I don't think you're sacrificing all that much in the way of upside. Like, you know, let's say that you know for a fact that draft pick turns into Matt Beniers or Carson Lambos. Well, once you've picked them, you know, does Columbus trade one for one its established number one center for your prospect who looks like they can be a number one center or look like they can be a top pair defenseman the day after the draft? I'm actually not sure they do. I think there's a mystery box element to a draft pick where you get to call your shot and you get to dream on it and take your pick that is almost more valuable. And I am someone who really likes Matt Beniers. Like, I think Matt Beniers should be coveted by all 32 NHL organizations, because Seattle will be in that draft. But I'm just saying, Pierre-Luc Dubois also kind of is the player that you want Matt Beniers to be. So to me, I think it's a no-brainer. Not a no-brainer. I shouldn't say that. To me, it's a perfectly fair request from Columbus, and one that I wouldn't be saying is off the table. But you just have to know your risk. And frankly, if you're the Red Wings, your assessment of where you are on your timeline is every bit as important here, because once you bring in an established 22-year-old center, you're not going to probably pick too many more years, especially as Moritz Seider and Lucas Raymond come into the organization. Like, you're almost saying, okay, the fourth pick and the sixth picks that we had for those 3 years, if you're Steve Yzerman, that's the core now, and you're probably going to be outside of that range at that point. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's good to get the franchise moving in a positive direction, and you don't want to chill in the basement for too long of the standings there. But these are the things you have to consider before you do it, for better or worse.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think you make a great point about teams kind of overvaluing their own first round picks to a certain extent. Like, you know, again, in this trade machine that, Dom Lucision and I have put together that will one day be public for you guys. The Detroit's got the most valuable 2021 first round pick, and it's got a value of what we call 9.7 when you're looking at excess value. Pierre-Luc Dubois, with only 2 years on a contract, is at 11.4. So it's already, if you're doing a straight up first rounder for Pierre-Luc Dubois, you're winning that deal if you're Detroit. And you could still throw on a, you know, a second and make that still a fair deal from Detroit's standpoint. So you're absolutely right about that, that point that first round picks tend to be overvalued here.
Yeah. All right. Let me see if I can find one more question. These are like all about Anthony Mantha.
Do you have some people very displeased with Anthony Mantha?
Do we have anything else we haven't said about Anthony Mantha today? Anything, any points not made? How about this one?
We really don't.
Thoughts on how Matias Bromé has started from Captain Slash.
I think it's very similar to Philip Zadina, right? He's looked really good in two games. I think you could argue that he's been Detroit's most consistent player in the first two games. I thought he looked great in game one on line three, and I thought he looked great in game two on line four. Guy really seems to play with the puck, seems to have good sense. Knows where how to put the puck in space, and has generated dangerous chances. You know, I think he was third in individual expected goals in the second game, and I think he was first in the first game. So he's arguably been Detroit's best forward, and I think a large part of that is, you know, like Zadina, having been playing consistently in the SHL and playing well consistently in the SHL. He's a guy who I think the Wings are very happy to have right now.
Here's what I'm interested in on this. I think Bromé has been good too. It sounds like you're a little higher on him maybe than I am. I think he's just looked like a legit bottom six NHLer, which coming from where the Red Wings were, that is a big deal. What happens when Darren Helm is back? Because Franz Nielsen's already out of the lineup. I think Adam Ernie has been one of the more noticeable Red Wings through two games, and he's a guy that's taken a lot of heat, you know, both from us on this show and from the public at large. I think he's looked really good. I think he's looked like exactly what they want the identity of that line to be. You're not taking Luke Glendening out of that lineup. Is it Matias Bromé or is it Valtteri Filppula? Like, who comes out? I mean, that Filppula line, like you said, was Detroit's most impactful line yesterday. Who comes out when Darren Helm comes back in?
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question right now, and I don't know the answer to that. I mean, you know, conventional sense would make you think it's going to be Matias Bromé, which would be, I think, kind of frustrating from his standpoint, given how well he's played thus far. But you're absolutely right. Adam Ernie's been great. In fact, if you look at the Red Wings leaders from the first two games, Ernie's their second in 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage, only behind Sam Gagne. And Ernie is one of two players above 50%. And that's kind of massively telling when you remember that Detroit was 30-some percent in the first two games. So, yeah, it hasn't been Adam Ernie. So I think it does fall on Bromé to be the one to come out of the lineup. But I think you have to be very encouraged with the way he played and, you know, be very excited about what he's done thus far.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will see. Hopefully you guys listen to this before Monday at noon, because that's when the Red Wings will next play. But either way, we'll be back at you in the middle of next week with our next episode. We'll break down what happens in the Columbus series, and we'll preview the first clash against Chicago for what actually could be very consequential divisional stakes already here, just in what will be the third series of the season for the Red Wings. But safe to say it's in full swing, and we'll be with you the whole way here. Just while I have you, I want to make sure that if you're not subscribing to The Athletic yet, we would love for you to join. You can get a subscription to The Athletic for $3.99 a month at theathletic.com/wingsforbreakfast. That's a discount for you as a listener. And we'd love to have you on board. We're obviously going to have plenty and plenty of Red Wings content throughout the year, prospect content for those of you who are more interested in that, draft coverage from Corey Promen and Scott Wheeler, national coverage from Craig Cousins, Pierre LeBrun, Scott Burnside. You're going to get the whole NHL. You're going to get the whole sports world, no matter who your teams are. Spring training's only a month away. We got NFL playoffs in full swing. The NBA, James Edwards, one of my best friends, killing it daily on the Pistons beat. You're not going to want to miss anything that he writes. So make sure you're joining us at The Athletic, theathletic.com/wingsforbreakfast, and we'll see you there.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.